polls close in several U.S. states and initial results trickle in as Americans vote to elect their next president between incumbent Donald Trump and his Democratic rival Joe Biden. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the U.S. presidential election will have no impact on Tehran's policies toward Washington. Also ahead, infections and fatalities from the coronavirus keep surging in Europe, with Italy reporting its highest daily death toll since May. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Early results are coming in from the U.S. presidential election in the final showdown between U.S. President Donald Trump and his Democratic rival Joe Biden. Early U.S. media projections show Trump has so far secured 13 Electoral College votes by winning Kentucky and West Virginia. This is while Biden is projected to have taken 16 Electoral votes after his victories in Vermont and Virginia. A record number of over 100 million Americans voted early, whether in person or through mail, amid a spiraling COVID-19 outbreak in the country. Final results may take days to be announced, as counting mail-in ballots is expected to be a time-taking process. And the breaking news, according to U.S. media, that Trump is projected winner in South Carolina. We'll bring you all the details as those polls close across the United States. Now, political commentator Frank Emspach says Trump's threat of social unrest is not likely to happen unless the vote is neck and neck.
I think that it can happen if the vote is relatively close. If the popular vote is, say, 6 or 7 or 8 million in Biden's favor, even if some of the battleground states are close, it's going to be very, very hard for the courts to toss out the election. But if a couple of the battleground states, particularly Pennsylvania and Florida, are very close, then I think we're going to see judicial intervention. But again, they have to weigh the level of social unrest. And what's different now between 2000, when President Bush beat Gore, or Gore basically surrendered, is that the Democratic Party at that point gave up. The Democratic Party now, and Biden, and all parts, many, many parts of the American political class and the political activists have said, we're not going to do the same thing that has happened in 2000. We will not accept a judicial transfer of power here, or a judicial maintenance of power. And so that's a change. And and I think that that may result in a peaceful transition. Also, Trump changed his position. That's a much more subdued person this afternoon than it was this morning. So hopefully he is not going to cause the kind of constitutional crisis that he's certainly capable of doing.
And according to media reports, Trump is the projected winner in Mississippi. Their results there from the U.S. trickling in state by state. Political commentator Rob Cowell, meanwhile, says the Electoral College was set up because the people in charge believed that Americans didn't have the wisdom to make the right decision.
Hillary won by almost 3 million votes. And Al Gore also won the popular vote in 2000. George Bush won the Electoral College, and Trump won the Electoral College, and that's what counts. The Electoral College was set up because at one time, I mean, the people in charge didn't believe that the people of America had the wisdom to make the right decisions. So they decided that what would happen is that electors would be elected, and then those electors would vote. And it ends up that it's really an archaic system that has produced not good democracy. And it's time to get rid of it, but it's hard to get rid of these archaic things because they benefit a lot of these smaller states. It gives a smaller state a bigger voice than it does larger states. Like, for example, California doesn't get as much representation per elector as a small state like Montana or Vermont does. And so you get an inequality. But I don't think that's going to happen this time.
Well, let's find out. Let's go to Miami. Ronnie Carvello is there. Ronnie, what's the latest where you are?
Well, the Florida already started counting their votes. Right now, we have Donald Trump with 55.7% and Biden with 43.4%. Trump got 470,000 votes and Biden 366. But it's just four counties, so it's a long way to go. It's a very early stage. What also can say is that Trump was able to get already the 11 electoral votes from Indiana, which was expected. But in Florida, the count just started.
Any idea, Ronnie, as to when that count will finish in Florida?
Well, I believe that in a few hours from now, Florida will release the final results. And that is very important, because if Biden gets this 29 electoral votes out of Florida, then is an indication what is going to happen in the next few days. But if Trump gets the 29 electoral votes, it's one more step for him, but it's not nothing that we can say that will be so nice as if those 29 is going to Biden.
Okay, great stuff. Thank you very much, Ronnie there. Ronnie Carvello, our correspondent in Miami. The acting U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security has denied any foreign vote manipulation in the 2020 presidential election. In a press conference, Chad Wolf said that there was no evidence that, quote, a foreign actor has succeeded in compromising or manipulating any votes in this election. He stressed that American election systems remain resilient despite what he called foreign attempts to hack them. Wolf also called on voters to be patient in waiting for election results. This comes as the U.S. government recently accused Russia, China, and Iran of trying to influence the 2020 election. After the election in 2016, the U.S. intelligence agencies claimed Moscow meddled in the votes with a campaign of email hacking. However, the Kremlin repeatedly denied playing any role in the election. And according to U.S. media there, Biden wins the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Massachusetts, and Delaware. Now, in the United States, the 2020 House and the Senate elections are also underway, with the Democratic Party trying to win back control of the upper chamber of Congress. Early results show that both Democrats and Republicans have managed to acquire one seat each in the Senate. This comes as 35 seats are up for grabs in the Senate controlled by the Republicans since 2015. Meanwhile, the Democrats are also trying to keep their lead in the lower chamber of Congress. 435 seats in the House of Representatives are up for grab. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the U.S. presidential election will have no impact on Tehran's policies toward Washington. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei noted that the U.S. political system is suffering a serious decline no matter who leads that country. He said Washington's hostility toward Tehran cannot be removed because Iranians will never surrender to America's will. Iran's leader was addressing the nation during a televised speech on the occasion of the birth anniversary of Islam's prophet. Ayatollah Khamenei also slammed certain Arab countries for normalizing ties with Israel. He urged the Muslim world to enhance unity in the face of the enemy's plots. Also in his remarks, Iran's leader denounced the French president's support for the blasphemous cartoons of the prophet Muhammad. Ayatollah Khamenei described as outrageous Emmanuel Macron's support for the insulting cartoons. Iran's leader also called for an immediate end to the ongoing fighting between Azerbaijan and Armenia over Nagorno-Karabakh. He said all Azeri territories occupied by Armenia must be liberated and returned to Azerbaijan. Ayatollah Khamenei stressed that the security of Armenians must be preserved and international borders must be respected by the warring sides. He warned that Iran will respond if terrorists approach its borders. Political commentator Tohid Asadi says the U.S. maintains a hostile grand strategy against Iran regardless of the party in power in Washington.
The Supreme Leader, I think, today touched upon a wide spectrum of issues, most important of which I can refer to the U.S. election and the current status of the ties between Iran and the United States. Well, the core element of this speech and his mindset indeed is based upon the very fact that when it comes to the grand strategies of Washington, we see a continuation of a same hostile, rancorous approach that they have started from four decades ago, and they had continued on up until the moment. And the key point of concern, back to his speeches, is that this grand strategy stays there, whether we like it or not, whether a Democratic or a Republican president comes to the office. The point is that, at least in terms of grand strategy, it doesn't matter really who comes to take the office. But when it comes to tactically speaking, I mean, there might be some differences between two sides. But the truth of the matter is that this same approach could be referred to in several examples even before the 1979 revolution. If you remember 1953 Cook in Iran, and if you remember what the United States has done throughout all these years, you will see one same trajectory of a kind of interventionist approach that Washington has started, and it has paved the way for further policies pertaining to Iran to take place.
Iran's ambassador to the UN says the US is in violation of a binding ruling by the International Court of Justice, which ordered Washington to lift some of its sanctions against Tehran. In a speech to the UN General Assembly, Majid Takht-Ravanchi said the US sanctions have impacted Iran's ability to engage in free trade. He said the US has paid no heed to the ICJ ruling, rather intensified its sanctions and coercive measures against Iran. Takht-Ravanchi said the sanctions have particularly impeded Iran's access to medicine and medical supplies during the coronavirus pandemic. Iran filed a lawsuit at the ICJ in 2018 against the US sanctions. The court ordered the US to provisionally lift its sanctions on items such as food and medicine until the tribunal issued its final verdict. Infections and deaths from the coronavirus keep surging in Europe, where stringent restrictions are in place to stem the spread of the pandemic. Italy has reported over 350 new deaths, the highest daily tally since May. It has also recorded over 28,000 new infections in 24 hours. In Germany, a senior health official has warned that the country could see more than 400,000 new cases by Christmas if the current pace on infections continues. France has reported more than 36,000 new infections and over 600 deaths in 24 hours. This as the government is preparing to impose further restrictions in the capital, Paris, a week after announcing a national lockdown.
In view of the situation that's been monitored, we are going to reinstate a curfew on Paris and perhaps other regions. The Interior Ministry will specify the details later in the day, and an edict will be issued.
In the Netherlands, the government has announced it will tighten lockdown measures to reduce infections. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte says a partial lockdown will be imposed from Wednesday and last until mid-December. A nighttime curfew also begins in Austria that will remain in place until the end of the month. Meanwhile, Hungary has also declared an emergency situation and imposed a nighttime curfew to curb infections. Senior Eurozone officials have warned about the consequences of tighter lockdown measures on Europe's economic recovery. The EU's Economic Affairs Commissioner said the new restrictions will seriously impact the continent's economic activity. Paolo Gentiloni, however, noted that the impact is likely not as bad as during the first wave of COVID-19 last spring. Klaus Regling, who heads the Eurozone's bailout fund, also warned of substantially higher risks of a double-dip recession in Eurozone nations. Eurozone finance ministers are calling for a quick approval of a massive stimulus package blocked in negotiations between the European Parliament and member states. The virus has infected over 10 million people in Europe. The terrorism threat level in the UK has been elevated to severe, meaning an attack is believed to be highly likely. The decision was taken by the Joint Terrorism Analysis Centre. The UK Home Secretary described the move as a precautionary measure following deadly attacks on Austria and France. Priti Patel said there would now be more visible policing across the country. Four people were killed in a gun rampage in Vienna on Monday night. The Daesh terrorist group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Last week, three people also died after a knife attack in Nice, France, while a teacher was murdered in Paris last month. Sympathies and condemnations have poured in following the deadly shooting in Vienna claimed by the Daesh terror group. Iran's foreign ministry expressed sorrow and called for international cooperation to root out terrorism. The European Union condemned the incident as a cowardly act. German Chancellor Angela Merkel called for a common struggle to fight, quote, assassins and those who instigate them. The Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte said there is no room for hatred and violence in Europe. The Russian President Vladimir Putin called the shooting a cruel crime that revealed the inhumane nature of terrorism. Other nations, including Britain, France, Canada, India, and Pakistan, issued similar messages.
Flags at half-mast as Austria mourns a shocking terrorist attack that left five people dead and up to 17 others injured. The victims include an elderly man and woman, a young passerby, and a waitress. The attacker himself, who is said to have fired randomly at people, was shot dead by police. Authorities have now confirmed he was a 20-year-old with Austrian citizenship and North Macedonian roots. The unnamed individual was sentenced to 22 months in prison back in April 2019 for attempting to travel to Syria to join the Daesh terrorist group. He'd been released from prison in December. Interior Minister Karl Nehammer said it's a situation Austria has never experienced before.
It was a completely inappropriate attempt to weaken our democratic society. In no case or in any way we will put up with that from anyone.
Chancellor Sebastian Kurz said the attack represented a hatred of Austria's way of life, pointing out that the enemy was neither a population group or a member of a religious community.
Our enemy is extremism and terrorists. It is not a conflict between Christians and Muslims, but a struggle between civilization and barbarism. This struggle will be fought with determination. This is why I have asked the Interior Minister to use all available sources to clarify the background of the crime.
Several people have already been arrested as police search for possible further perpetrators.
Vienna's inner city was at the heart of a large-scale anti-terrorist operation on Monday night. The now identified perpetrator was shot and killed by police shortly after 8 p.m. His apartment was forcibly opened with explosives and searched. As of now, downtown Vienna has been declared a red zone, meaning it's the most susceptible to possible further attacks. Homolezki, Vienna.
The European Commission says Britain has breached the one-month deadline for responding to the EU's formal complaint about London's plan to breach the Brexit agreement. The Commission spokesperson, Daniel Ferry, said the bloc will consider escalating its legal dispute with Britain over the violation of the withdrawal treaty. Last month, the EU sent a formal notice to London over its internal market bill that breaches agreements in the treaty ending Britain's membership of the EU. Ferry added that the bloc is fully committed to achieving, quote, full implementation of the withdrawal agreement within the remaining time available. And in other news, the death toll from Monday's terrorist attack on Kabul University has risen to at least 35, with most of the victims being students. Government sources have been quoted as saying that around 50 people had also been wounded in the attack that was later claimed by the Daesh terror group. Three gunmen stormed the university, shooting at students and clashing with security forces for hours on Monday. The gunfight followed an explosion. At the time, Afghan and Iranian officials were inaugurating a book exhibition on the campus. Officials later confirmed that all three assailants were shot dead by security forces. President Ashraf Ghani condemned the attack and pledged to avenge the deaths. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Culture, Eastern Tales, Roundtable Discussions, Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Dear listeners, the article you are about to hear has been authored by Asoka Bandraj and carries the title, The Quest for a Treaty Prohibiting Nuclear Weapons. Stay tuned, please. Of all the weapons created throughout human history, nuclear weapons are the most destructive and indiscriminate. They are capable of causing enormous devastation involving uniquely persistent, spreading, genetically damaging radioactive fallout. Whereas a single nuclear bomb detonated over a large city could kill millions of people, the deployment of tens or hundreds of them could disrupt the global climate, creating intolerable conditions for both humans and other species. The Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, commonly known as the Non-Proliferation Treaty, was adopted in 1970 with the objectives of halting the adoption of these weapons and disarming those that already existed. The NPT recognized five states as nuclear weapon states. In order of acquisition, they are the US, Russia, the UK, France, and China. The NPT has had limited success in curtailing nuclear weapons proliferation, and the five recognized nuclear weapons states have also shown a reluctance to disarm. Since the adoption of the NPT, three more states, India, Pakistan, and North Korea, have conducted overt nuclear tests. North Korea, which had been a party to the NPT, withdrew in 2003, while the Zionist regime, which is known to have nuclear weapons, does not acknowledge it. Five more states, including Belgium, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, and Turkey, also host U.S. nuclear weapons. 26 other countries endorsed the possession and use of nuclear weapons on their behalf in accordance with defense alliances, including the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and the Collective Security Treaty Organization. Despite the NPT's calls for a diminishing role for nuclear weapons in security policies, the five declared nuclear weapon states have maintained huge stockpiles, leading critics to question the legitimacy and enforcement capacity of the treaty. U.S. plans to develop new weapons, including anti-ballistic missiles, earth-penetrating bunker busters, and new small bombs, have been of particular concern. Countries like New Zealand also see the NPT's inability to subject the Israeli regime to the treaty's restrictions as a major problem. As geopolitical conflicts intensify, nuclear weapon states continue to modernize and rearm their arsenals. The danger of a limited nuclear war, if not a full-scale one, in the near future is real. Among those leading the movement to ban nuclear weapons are the few remaining victims of the U.S. nuclear bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. Meanwhile, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, TPNW, was adopted at the United Nations on July 7, 2017, with the support of 122 nations. The TPNW, also known as the Nuclear Weapon Ban Treaty, is the first legally binding international agreement comprehensively to prohibit nuclear weapons and to seek their total elimination. Article 1 of the Treaty on Prohibitions states that each state party undertakes never under any circumstances to do the following: develop, test, produce, manufacture, otherwise acquire, possess, or stockpile nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices, transfer to any recipient whatsoever nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices, or control over such weapons or explosive devices directly or indirectly, receive the transfer of or control over nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices directly or indirectly, use or threaten to use nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices, assist, encourage, or induce in any way anyone to engage in an activity prohibited to a state party under this treaty, seek or receive any assistance in any way from anyone to engage in any activity prohibited to a state party under this treaty, allow any stationing, installation, or deployment of any nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices in its territory or at any place under its jurisdiction or control. For the TPNW to come into effect, 50 countries must sign and ratify the treaty. As of October 23rd, 84 states had signed and 49 had ratified or acceded to it. Only one more state is needed to complete ratification. A mere 90 days after the 50th ratification, the TPNW will enter force as international law, binding on countries that have ratified it. In the meantime, stating that it won't sign the TPNW, U.S. President Donald Trump's administration continues to move away from international agreements to curtail nuclear weapons. On August 2, 2019, the Trump administration officially withdrew from 1987 Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty between the United States and Russia. The U.S. and Russia are currently negotiating an extension of the New Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or a New START, the only remaining treaty placing limits on the growth of the world's two largest nuclear arsenals. New START is set to expire on February 5, 2021. Meanwhile, the United States is urging countries that have ratified the TPNW to withdraw their support as the pact nears the 50 ratifications. The TPNW supporters believe that the 50th ratification needed to bring it into effect could happen anytime soon. However, a recent letter sent by the Trump administration to signatories and obtained by the Associated Press states that the five original nuclear powers, including the US, Russia, China, Britain, and France, and America's NATO allies, stand unified in our opposition to the potential repercussions of TPNW. The letter also states that the TPNW is detrimental to the objectives of NPT, claimed to be the cornerstone of global non-proliferation efforts. It further says to the countries that have ratified the TPNW, "Although we recognize your sovereign right to ratify or accede to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, TPNW, we believe that you have made a strategic error and should withdraw your instrument of ratification or accession." Beatrice Finn, the executive director of International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, the sponsor of TPNW, responded by saying that the Trump administration is pressuring countries to withdraw from a United Nations-backed disarmament treaty is an unprecedented action in international relations, shows how fearful they are of the treaty's impact and growing support. It should be noted that there is no fundamental difference between the Democratic and Republican parties on the U.S. foreign policy and U.S. militarism. Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has affirmed support for continuation of U.S. military and imperial agendas. In the meantime, small and medium-sized countries have joined the TPNW to avoid possible nuclear build-ups and conflagrations on their soil. Indeed, the vast majority of countries that have ratified the TPNW thus far are small states struggling to maintain their neutrality from nuclear-armed states.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and congratulations to you all on the blessed birthday anniversary of the Seed of Messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. The day also happens to be the birth anniversary of the Prophet's sixth infallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. In honor of this day of double blessings, we have selected for you an enlightened statement from the Prophet of Islam. I was sent by God to complete the best of morals.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters in faith. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother, I'm Muhammad. And today, I'm going to read to you an aphorism of Imam Ali from Nahjul Balagha. Before that, let's go ahead and listen to the Arabic words, and after that, I'm going to read you the English translation. Stay with us.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام لا يعاب المرء بتأخير حقه إنما يعاب من أخذ ما ليس له.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "No person is to be blamed for delay in securing his own right, but blame lies on him who takes what he is not entitled to."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. One of the great things which we learn from Imam Ali is the fact that he was truly the lantern of the path. Even after the passing of over 1,000 years, we find that the theories and the concepts, the practices and the ideas put forth by Imam Ali alayhi salam are still very much relevant to today's day and age. Now, of course, we don't consider this to be a miracle per se regarding Imam Ali alayhi salam, meaning this knowledge wasn't derived on his own per se, because of course the knowledge of Imam Ali is the knowledge of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and the knowledge of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household, the knowledge of the Holy Prophet is the knowledge of Allah the Almighty. And so of course when the knowledge of the Almighty, of Allah the Exalted, is pure, it is perfect, and so when he gives this knowledge to whom he pleases, to whom he chooses, we find that people like the Holy Prophet, people like Lady Fatima Zahra, people like Imam Ali, when they put forth their ideas, which are in reality truth and the perfection of wisdom, we find that they are endless, and thus they have lasted for over 1,000 years. And so this is why theories put forth by a common man who is not connected to Allah, they have to be modified or disproved or are found to be false one day or the other. It is interesting, but as far as the economic models the world used to look towards communism, but communism has failed. And on the other hand, if we look at the capitalist economic model, that too, in the present time, is suffering and is about to fail if it hasn't already failed. Now, the main reason is that these ideas or these theories or these concepts, they do not have the correct and absolute knowledge, the perfect knowledge of all the facts, all the variables of the universe. And so theories are propped up and put forwards based upon conjecture and eventually create a falsehood, or they create something that will be broken. But on the other hand, as we said, if we consider one as Imam Ali, who has authentic knowledge of the truths of divine recognition of Ma'rifah, one who has received his training from the Holy Prophet, can this person commit a mistake in deriving conclusions and putting forth judgments? Of course not. The thoughts of such a person, such as Imam Ali, never move away from the pivotal perfect center, which is Allah, the Exalted. And so a profound lesson within the life of Imam Ali, and for us all to know, Imam Ali is truly the lantern of the path, brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
Some other, you know, different variety of questions from Ka'ab al-Ahbar, who was a former Jewish scholar who had become Muslim during the days of the second Khalifa. And he had some very, you know, kind of trick questions many times. He says, لَوْ سُدَّ عَلَىٰ رَجُلٍ بَابُ بَيْتٍ وَتُرِكَ فِيهِ. If a person is imprisoned in his house, it is, you know, locked from outside. Nobody has access to him. Where will Allah send him his rizq from? His sustenance. How will it come to him? And the style of Amir al-Mu'mineen is very interesting. He says, well, is he going to die or not? The way Malak al-Maut is going to reach there, if Allah wants, the rizq of that person also can reach there, in spite of the fact that he has been locked inside the house. He is our imam. He is our, you know, mark of identity. We call ourselves Shi'atu Ali. Let us make a commitment to know him, to know his wisdom, to understand his knowledge that he has left behind for us. You know, we can make a commitment at least once a week. Let us go to the last part of Nahj al-Balagha, which is the section of the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and at least read one saying a week. At least by the end of the year, we would have learned 52 sayings from the hikmah and wisdom of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam. Sometimes people say Nahj al-Balagha is very difficult. You don't need to go through the khutbas. You don't need to go through the letters. Just go to the last section, where they are very short sayings, you know, 2-3 lines, some lengthy, but you read it at least once a week, just one saying. This is how you will get closer to Amir al-Mu'mineen in spirit. It will be as if he is talking to you. He is talking to you even after the centuries, and he would like to see those qualities in us as the Shias of Ali. Of course, there are many other, you know, resources. These days, nobody can say, oh, it's not available in my language, or I, you know, don't want to buy it. You know, you can get all these things free now online. You know, just search Nahj al-Balagha, whether you're looking in one language or another. You know, you can always go through when you look at the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
In this day and age, for this generation, with all of the resources that you have at your disposal that your predecessors did not have, but you have now, the means to communicate across some very serious divides and make the decisions to eradicate the artificial barriers that have been erected for us, and begin to carve out some new ground based on the history of Islam in America and in the African-American Muslim community and the struggles that were fought for our faith and the right to name ourselves and to have our faith front and center, to have our faith define who we are. We always sought to have people know who we were by our faith tradition. We certainly could not change the color of our skin, right? But we wanted people to know who we were as a religious community. And this goes back centuries ago. The enslaved Africans who came here, many of them came as Muslims, and they were stripped of their language and their culture, their names, their identities. And we never ask the question, we say, oh, they lost their religion. But in fact, they didn't lose their religion. So we didn't ask the question, well, what happened to those Muslims? Who are they? You know, what became of them? And what happened to them? So I will ask you to take the initiative to do the research yourself and find out who your ancestors are. And they are not just those ancestors that you might be aware of from back home, because many of them came to these shores and settled on this shore. In terms of struggle, we're all in some form of struggle, but we need to get out of the habit of apologizing for who we are and just take the plunge to stand up and be who we are, to challenge the status quo, and that we must do. Otherwise, we are simply complicit in all of the wrongdoing that comes in our name. And we have to be the ones to stand up and say, not in my name. You will not commit atrocities. You will not abuse people. You will not malign people, whether they are Muslims or not, in our names. As active, viable citizens of this land, we have a responsibility. And I say to you that you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You have a legacy of a community that has done that and continues to do that consistently. One of the things that I like to share and that really irks me to this day is we see so many images of starving children in Africa. We never broach the subject of Africa as one of the richest, if not the richest, continent on the planet. So my question is, why? Why are they starving? Why are they suffering? Where are all the resources? We are people who have had our resources and our wealth usurped, taken from us, stolen from us. And you don't really realize blood, sweat, and tears that went into making, you know, the foundational pieces that went into making this country through the free labor that was contributed by enslaved Africans, many of them who were Muslim. These are histories that you need to know so that when you go out and talk about the degrees that we have, you know, and the wealth that we've accumulated over time, when you entered the class of elites, many of us, you have to know and remember and reach back that there are communities of color, specifically African-American communities, that have paved the way for your ascension into these categories and begin to push back on the obvious atrocities that you see perpetrated every day before you in the name of democracy. You know that many of our children are suffering right here at home, the prison industrial complex, from school, the pipeline to prison, right? Why are young black men and more increasingly young black women targeted and incarcerated? And we have viable research that talks to us about how our children are treated in schools, girls and boys, how they are targets, not just by their peers, but by law enforcement at a very early age. The educational system that we've always challenged as African Americans in this country. We early on understood that we had to educate our own children because we knew that they were not going to get the kind of education that they needed to survive and prosper. Well, that still remains as we enter the vaulted halls of the elite universities in this country, the Ivy League communities. We also know that those Ivy League universities are predicated on their involvement in slavery in the early days. So we should never underestimate the power of that kind of legacy, how it continues to influence and carry into the world as we become adults, accomplished professionals, and go out in the world and speak about advancement, liberation, so forth. We need to go back home and create some really serious conversations within our communities about what side of the equation are we on. You know, do we want to be a part of the solution, or are we content to be a part of the problem and reap whatever benefits are given to us as a result of our complicity? So that is not the way of viable Muslim. We are always pushing for a greater liberty for everyone, including our own, but never just our own, because when we push for the greater community, our Muslim community is part of that as well. So I say also younger people need to have a seat at the table from the beginning, so that we can hear their voices and plan for their future. And I would like to request that we begin to reach out to the Native American community. We didn't just land here, you know. These people, they've been here for a while. And when we are facing climate change, these are the communities that we need to be embracing and learning from. We have a lot of work to do, but we have a lot of also unrealized allies in the world. So to get out of our silos, to be bold enough to challenge the status quo. Don't go along with what we know is unjust because it's in our own perceived interest, because ultimately it is not in your own best interest. But when we fight for total liberation for everybody. And when we do that, we see that, wow, the world is really, really a beautiful place. And we're all struggling together, and our umbrella gets wider and bigger, and then you can really enjoy the diversity of this great community that we call Islam in America. So we stand ready to stand by you and urge you on to be fierce and bold in your opposition to oppression, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.